The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Jessen, Judge Flory, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning, counsel. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You are our first oral argument of two on our calendar today. And the case is A20-1226, Abbas Ibrahim Mohammed versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it. And I'd ask, as always, when you start your arguments, your principal arguments, please state your name and the party you represent for the record. With that, counsel for appellant, we are ready for you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Stephen Grigsby, and I represent the appellant in this matter. Let me begin simply by reading verbatim Subdivision 2 of the post-conviction statute.
It says this. Let me, before you dive into it, I see that the clock has not yet started. I don't think it has. Okay, Marshall, there we go. Go ahead, Mr. Grigsby. Sorry for that interruption.
Subdivision 2 reads verbatim of the legislative mandate that this remedy takes the place of any other common law statutory or other remedies which may have been available for challenging the validity of a conviction, a sentence, or other disposition.
And it must be reading from, counsel? I'm sorry.
Subdivision 2 of the post-conviction statute.
Go ahead.
And it must be used exclusively in the place of them unless it is inadequate or ineffective to test the legality of the conviction, sentence, or other disposition. Now, the jurisprudence with Lunzer and those cases seem to be pretty clear that post-conviction relief is not available to anybody with a stay of adjudication because it's not a conviction. But that would seem to directly contradict the other disposition that is mentioned in the statute. So I don't think tenable. There is simply an error in the interpretation of the post-conviction statute for other disposition. It specifically applies itself to other disposition, and there is no other disposition other than sentence, conviction, or a stay of adjudication. Now, I don't think that's ultimately critical for this argument that we've made here, because in this case, the appellant did not file a post-conviction relief. This appellant filed a motion to withdraw a plea. The court.
So let me, counsel, thank you for that. Now I understand the court, directed it in a via post-conviction, and it's decided it was unavailable under Johnston, the Court of Appeals decision now, which has since been, I think, affirmed by the Supreme Court post your briefing. So what I understand this case to come down to is whether you have available to you a Rule 15.05 motion to withdraw a plea as a separate avenue of relief from post-conviction review. Is that right?
That's absolutely right.
And you're arguing then that Johnston doesn't dictate because Johnston dealt with post-conviction.
That's correct.
One more question, then I'll let you launch in. In all material respects, except for the mechanism chosen to withdraw a plea, Johnston looks just like this case. There's a stay of adjudication, successful probation, discharge, then a request to withdraw plea. And Johnston references in the footnotes, and then the majority responds to the dissent, that at oral argument, they discussed whether 15.05 was available instead of post-conviction relief. And they say they're not addressing it, yet they deny relief. I'm trying to understand whether Johnston really contemplates that if you happen to style your request as a post-conviction petition, you lose, but didn't think to just construe it as a motion to withdraw under 15.05, if that would give relief. That seems like a very harsh result that Johnston would have been, providing there, if all it needed to do is construe it as a motion.
Well, I think that that's exactly right. That's consonant with the argument I'm making. But the bottom line comes down to this. This is a this is Supreme Court of the United States precedent that we're following that says people who receive ineffective assistance of counsel with deportation consequences are entitled to a remedy. There is simply that's essentially the court's problem at this point, because the one thing the court can't do is to say this constitutional problem is not justiciable in Minnesota, both because you're obliged to accept Supreme Court's precedent and because the Minnesota Constitution, in a very unused clause, gives a remedy for every wrong. So the court has a lot of latitude in how it wishes to construe pleadings. The pleadings really ought not to matter that well. This court could have construed any post-conviction pleading as a misstated petition to withdraw the guilty plea. But it appears that we've come down to really only one of two choices for an act that has to be performed, and that is the litigation and vindication of a constitutional right that would ultimately be, without that, simply a class of constitutional violations that is without remedy in the courts. And the way this court did it was particularly problematic because it deemed the pleadings to be the very form that disqualifies the remedy that they seek.
Mr. Grigsby, though, doesn't the Supreme Court in Johnston contemplate that unfortunately Mr. Johnston was left without a remedy, even assuming that his rights under Padilla were violated? How could we be obligated to do something different when the dissent in Johnston even says that the majority opinion that provides no way for Mr. Johnston to right a constitutional wrong? I mean, it seems contemplated in that case.
Well, it may be, but can this court actually write an opinion that says Minnesota does not vindicate the Padilla rights of people within the state? I don't think so.
But can we do otherwise if the Supreme Court has so concluded in Johnston?
Well, it hasn't. The Supreme Court exercises limited appellate jurisdiction. And it has, in the exercise of a very narrow appellate jurisdiction, the right to simply consider only the evidence, the arguments and issues framed and put it before it in that way. There is nothing in that opinion that forecloses the constitutional right. It says that in the limited record, in the limited arguments, and the limited issues presented, appellate jurisdiction doesn't allow them to affirm that. But is the court suggesting that because the Supreme Court said it, that the class of Padilla defendants simply don't have their constitutional rights vindicated? There are, I've presented an alternative. There's a motion to withdraw the plea that if you examine the language of that, everything that the appellant did in this case complied with the motion to withdraw a plea. It can be done at any time, and it can be done for a manifest injustice. And I don't know what a manifest injustice could be if not the failure to vindicate a constitutional right.
Do you have counsel? Go ahead, Judge Flory. My apologies.
Yeah, no, that's all right. I guess my question is, I'm sympathetic to your argument here in terms of the lack of a remedy. I don't know if I'm as sympathetic to your suggestion that we disagree with our Minnesota Supreme Court precedent. But my question is, what do we make of the Supreme Court's rather broad statement in the James decision that says post-conviction relief is the only avenue to withdraw a guilty plea after sentencing? And of course, that creates the catch-22 if you apply Johnson. So I don't know. That inconsistency is troubling to me. And what are we to make of the Supreme Court's rather broad statement in James?
The only precedential matter in that is that which is strictly necessary to achieve the result. The rest is dicta. I do not believe they are inconsistent. There is no language that eternally forecloses the vindication of these rights. It almost is absurd to interpret Johnston to be that broad, because it would directly contradict the Supreme Court's language in the motion to withdraw a plea. The other really sort of sinister dimension of this is that post-conviction, because it purports to simply replace in its entirety all other remedies, makes habeas corpus, which is the common law writ that it essentially replaced, essentially a suspended writ, because it doesn't provide for precisely what habeas corpus would have done, which is unconstitutional detention. So it essentially, the Supreme Court interpreting that way is suspending the writ of habeas corpus. And this is also federally mandated. I have given you what I think is a very straightforward way to do it. And it doesn't even matter whether it's a motion to withdraw a plea. It doesn't matter whether it's post-conviction relief. The only pertinent matter in the pleadings is to give notice to everybody about the issue being raised. And that issue of Padilla is raised squarely, and it's raised clearly. It has just been essentially evaded by these these gymnastics.
I don't think you could be suggesting that if this were a petition for post-conviction relief, we could ignore Johnston. I mean, obviously we're bound by Johnston. I think your argument, your only possible argument, is there's an alternative, which is a motion under 1505. Maybe you disagree with me, but I don't see how we could refuse to follow Johnston if this were a petition for post-conviction.
I'm not suggesting the court has to abrogate or doesn't have the power, this level right. of appellate jurisdiction. But I don't think that you can treat dicta, which you commonly dismiss in other situations when it's necessary, as precedent.
The dicta in James. You're talking about James or Johnston there?
I think they're both dicta.
Okay. Well, we'll leave that aside for a moment then. And then let's talk about the Rule 15 motion. What Johnston talks about, again, I'm pretty like up until the point of requesting plea withdrawal, I think the cases are materially the same. Johnston says we're not addressing whether Rule 15.05 is available to a defendant. I'm not sure what they mean by available, but we do know that timeliness, a timely motion, is required under 15.05. In Reyes-Campos, the Supreme Court said we're not addressing whether it's timely when a motion was brought during a probationary period. They just decided it. But what makes, is there any authority that a 15.0, that you can point us to, that a motion under 15.05 to withdraw a plea is timely when it postdates discharge following a stay of adjudication? I mean, it's not in your brief, and I assume there's nothing on that, but I wanted to understand, like, what do you think the outer limits of timeliness are?
They are exactly what is written in Rule 15, and it says—
Well, it says timely.
It says any time. They may be brought at any time. That's in my brief.
Doesn't it say, I don't have the rule right in front of me, upon a timely motion? Maybe I'm mistaken.
Well, it says at any time. And that's in my brief. But you know, the timeliness jurisprudence, which has essentially developed out of the post-conviction line of cases, with the interests of justice exception, has basically said you have, for post-conviction, you are limited to 2 years when you become aware of it. But of course, since this is not post-conviction, this is Rule 15, that time limit simply wouldn't apply.
Right, I look at the rule and it does say at any time upon a timely motion. So the word timely is in there. In neither Reyes-Campos nor in Johnston does it speak to what a timely motion is, but it suggests that it's not a forever thing.
It says timely. The broadness of timely is generally related to the purpose, which is to value finality in some matter. But as you know, with Padilla, this was specifically the time was enlarged because it had retrospective application. So the real issue is that this court can't decide timely because it's not raised as an appellate issue because Rule 15 was disregarded in favor of post-conviction. If that is an issue in the first instance, it must be answered by a court of original jurisdiction. And that would require remand if the court believes that is the case for arguments with respect to whether it was timely or not. And then given what happens, it can be brought back up again.
Mr. Grigsby, is there anything in the record that indicates when the issue of mandatory deportation came up in this case? Meaning, was it before Mr. Muhammad was discharged from probation successfully, or did that issue of deportation come up after?
I honestly don't know the answer. I don't believe that's part of the record.
All right. And that was my question, whether there's anything in the record.
And that's all I have.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is George Kennedy. I'm an assistant Sherburne County attorney, and I appear on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. As the court pointed out, the question before the court today is a limited one, whether the post-conviction court abused its discretion in dismissing the petition. But based on the Supreme Court's recent decision in Johnston v. State, the answer to that question is no. According to the majority, there is no procedural mechanism for a district court to vacate a vacated stay of adjudication, which is what we have here.
Well, Judge Jessen, go ahead.
So, Mr. Kennedy, isn't that the case only if we read the Johnson case in conjunction with James, which brings us back to the question I think we were talking with Mr. Grigsby about. So is that, you know, language in James that a motion to withdraw a plea after sentencing must be raised in the post-conviction petition, is that dicta? Or not? How binding is that?
I believe that the language, and that's in footnote 5, it may be judicial dicta because the court had that conversation during oral argument about construing the petition as a Rule 1505 motion. And instead of remanding for analysis of whether to construe it as post-conviction or Rule 1505, they instead affirmed the denial of relief. That option was before them.
Well, but Mr. Kennedy, I thought that footnote 5 ends in this issue is not before us, right?
That's correct, but there was still a discussion about that, and the remedy, the remand was available, and I believe that it's actually what Justice Thiessen was recommending in his dissent.
So I'm going back to the James versus State case. So my question was really, is what the court said in James dicta or not? Because I think, as Judge Flory said, isn't it the juxtaposition of James and Johnson that gets us into, at least for appellant here at Catch-22?
And We've had a discussion about James. What part of James in particular is the court asking about? That post sentencing.
Right, that a motion to withdraw a plea after sentencing must be raised in a post conviction petition, because isn't it that language when you combine that with Johnson that is the challenge here?
I don't think that that's dicta because we do have a line of cases that's developed where plea withdrawal motions filed after a sentencing hearing are channeled through post-conviction. And that seems to be what the majority was suggesting in footnote 5, that even if a plea withdrawal motion had been filed in that case, the district court could have funneled it through post-conviction which would have resulted in dismissal on the same outcome.
Here's the question I have, and this is, you know, James was from 2005, I believe, and it was a case where the defendant was convicted and sentenced, and it observed that a plea withdrawal following sentence, may only be pursued via post-conviction relief. Subsequent decisions in Dupree and in Johnston make clear that when there's a stay of adjudication that's discharged, there was neither a conviction nor a sentence. So I'm questioning whether James has any application to this case at all. I mean, Johnston didn't reference it at all. It would have been an easy thing to reference in Johnston, saying that this is the only way to go. So I'm wondering why James would even have any application here. And then I confess confusion as to, you know, what you just completely accurately highlighted, that the court said it could have been if there was a motion pursued analyzed via post-conviction relief in Johnston, but it doesn't say it would have to be. So my concern is Johnston doesn't expressly exclude a motion under Rule 1505. On the other hand, why should there be a different result? And that goes to appellant. Like, why just the caption that you put on the pleading would lead to a different result also doesn't seem right when all other material facts are the same. So I guess speak to James, why we'd even apply here.
I think that before we had Johnston, there was a gap that courts and litigants were turning to James to address, because we have situations where a case is dismissed following a stay of adjudication, and we didn't have any case law analyzing what to do in those circumstances for a plea withdrawal motion. So James was guiding, even though it talks about post-sentencing, which based on Dupree and other recent cases, does not happen until the stay is revoked and a conviction is entered. But instead, what we have here, it's a dismissal following successful completion of probation with a stay of adjudication. And as Justice Thiessen pointed out in his dissent in footnote 1, for purposes of Minnesota law, it is as if that guilty plea and conviction never occurred. So from a state court perspective, this remedy has already been granted. The only question here is whether a federal consequence turns this into something that creates a right to a remedy in Minnesota. And I think that that's what the Supreme Court was dealing with in Johnston, and why they said there is no procedural mechanism to vacate a dismissal following a stay of adjudication.
Do they say that literally? That would be helpful, that there's no procedural mechanism, as opposed to that
it's post-conviction. It's in footnote maybe. 5.
Okay.
In footnote 5, they say that there is no procedural mechanism for the district court to vacate a vacated stay of adjudication, which is what appellant is asking for here. He's asking the court to undo a dismissed stay of adjudication. And there is no mechanism in post-conviction or the rules of criminal procedure that addresses that scenario.
I'm looking again at footnote 5, and you're right. The court says, and there is no procedural mechanism for the district court to vacate a vacated stay of adjudication. But then it ends that footnote. After it says that it notes the dissent suggesting a rule 15.05, and then says, this issue is not before us. So if they hadn't add that last sentence, this issue is not before us, I would agree with you that you know, phrase in footnote 5 would be, if not direction, at least guidance to us. But the last sentence, wouldn't you agree, muddies the water?
I think that the last sentence refers to the second to last sentence, where they're talking about construing a Rule 1505 petition as a Chapter 590 petition. So that issue was raised for the first time during oral argument, I believe, by the Supreme Court. It had not been briefed or litigated by the parties. The court, as I said earlier, could have used its authority to remand for further proceedings on that issue. However, it instead affirmed the lower court's decisions denying relief. I do want to point to one other thing just from the record. When this action was originally filed, it's been referred to as a motion to withdraw a guilty plea, but it wasn't solely framed as that when you actually look at the document. So it was submitted as a plea withdrawal motion pursuant to Rule 1505, and in the alternative, a request for post-conviction relief. So this post-conviction request was before the district court from the outset, and the court needed to define the proceedings going forward. We have this body of law following James and Lessier about when a plea withdrawal motion is timely. You don't have that same body of law under Rule 1505 Subdivision 1, particularly when you have a dismissed stay of adjudication. So I think that there is merit to using that James body of cases to analyze a motion in these circumstances. So,
Mr. Kennedy, let me ask you this based upon what you just said. Is the issue of how the district court treated this motion, i.e. dismiss the motion and directing a post-conviction petition to be brought, is that issue before us at this time, whether the court abused its discretion and how it treated that initial motion?
The way that the appeal was filed, it was after the ultimate dismissal, based on construing this as a post-conviction petition. There wasn't an appeal taken directly from the order, the post-conviction order, construing this as a Chapter 590 petition instead of a Rule 15 motion. I suppose the court could say that it relates back to that original order, but the waters are a little bit muddied here because the appeal was taken from the dismissal, not the order deciding how to analyze the petition.
Well, I think and we'll look carefully at that, of course, but the appellant did bring alternative grounds. The district court decided that only one was available because of James. If we were to conclude that James was not actually, did not dictate that result, because James dealt with someone who had been sentenced, unlike the appellant here, you know, we'd have to consider whether the answer would be, well, appeal taken from the wrong order, or whether it relates to it, as you say. If we were to decide that the district court should have considered a Rule 15.05 motion and its availability, that door is open after Johnston, would a remand be required? Or would we be able to decide this case in the appellant's favor on the record before us, if we thought there was the possibility of a 15.05 remedy?
I think that a remand would be required, Your Honor, because we do have unresolved questions of fact. As this case was going through the post-conviction court, the state answered with a denial, an argument about timeliness under 590.01 subdivision 4B. So there are procedural and substantive issues that have not yet been addressed under a, if it gets bounced back as a 590 petition, and then if it is remanded under 1505, we still have to figure out whether or not this was timely, taking into consideration that it was filed after the dismissal. And we then need to get into the question of whether or not a manifest injustice occurred. There are allegations, but we have not yet had judicial findings that this court could review to decide the whether or not there was an abuse of discretion or error in the district court's analysis.
Let me ask you, Mr. Kennedy, about Reyes-Campos. That was a case in 2012 where the Supreme Court entertained and actually remanded on a motion to withdraw a plea. That happened, I believe, during the probationary period of someone who had been adjudicated guilty but was on a stay of imposition of sentence. It wasn't treated as post-conviction. The Supreme Court expressly said, we're not saying whether this is timely because no one has argued, there's been no argument made about timeliness. But it is an example of a pre-sentence, so different from ours, which is post-discharge, I understand all of that, but it's a pre-sentencing, I'm gonna go over time a little bit, application of a motion to withdraw a plea. How does that factor in here? It's post-James.
I think Reyes-Campos is limited because the remand was based on a very small procedural issue where there had been no questioning. There had been no question during the plea that covered the part of the plea petition rights. Specifically, there was no warning under 1505 subdivision 1 paren 6 sub paren L about
right. The basis to withdraw the plea was different because it wasn't ineffective assistance of counsel. It was a rule violation. But it was not funneled into a post conviction relief framework. Let me put it that way. It was the motion was still considered even though it was during a probationary period, pre-sentencing, post-conviction.
And I think that the other distinguishing factor there, Your Honor, is that the state was agreeing to that remand. My review of that case is that it was filed as a post-conviction petition. And the issue of that rule violation came up during litigation at the Supreme Court. There was essentially a joint request to remand for relief under that very narrow provision.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, counsel. Any rebuttal? Oops, sorry, we need your muting there.
Sorry, I think I can do it very briefly. There's really only one outcome here that is forbidden by anything that resembles a legal decision, a valid legal decision, and that is to simply say there is no remedy for people who receive stay of adjudications with ineffective assistance of counsel and face deportation, period. I don't think it matters, as the court noted, how you characterize or frame the petition. Everybody was on notice in one way or another that this was Padilla, that there was a claim of ineffective assistance, and the person's entitled to a hearing and a remedy. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Case is submitted, helpful oral arguments and briefing. We'll have a decision out in the statutory time period. Thank you.